let me see if you share that.
Let me try this. Is that better? Okay, very good. Thank you. Thanks for bringing
turn this off.
And we're told that the lighting staff will come in till 10 a.m. So that's okay. We all look younger in this lighting.
Bring the mic closer, please.
Oh, I will. Thank you.
Thanks for letting me show the mic.
All right. Thank you. It's 9 a.m., so we'll get started. Welcome, everybody, to CU Boulder's 71st Annual Conference on World Affairs. If your intent is to be at panel number 4106, titled Family Matters, Modern Family Dynamics, congratulations, you are in the right place. And for the purposes of recording and streaming, I'll mention that we are at Old Main Chapel, starting at 9 a.m. Friday, April 12th, and we will be ending at 10:10 a.m. My name is Betty Erickson, and I am the moderator. This topic, discussing families, is of particular interest to me. Our very helpful producers are Ashley Bryant and Janet Hatton, and they are here to assist you in whatever capacity you need. And they keep us on schedule and help with any logistical needs that they're able to. This Conference on World Affairs session uses both the CWA app and note cards to ask questions. I've already received one question. Thank you. You may get on your apps anytime. To ask a question in the app, tap Q&A and then insert your question and send. Please indicate if you are a student before your question because we yield to students first. You may ask your question via note card also. Just let one of our producers know. You'd like a note card and a pencil? Please write legibly and make your question brief and to the point. Our distinguished panelists here include Ali Barda, Tulio Cardoza, Carolina Quiroga-Stultz, and Nancy Janice, in that order. I will introduce each panelist separately, and they will follow my introduction with a few remarks, about 8 or 10 minutes, and then we'll go ahead and take audience questions. I'll start with Ms. Barda first, Ali Barda. She and I may stand during the presentation. It's about an hour, and we get a little antsy, so we might stand. Allie lives with her husband, Chris, and their dog, Brewer, in Richmond, Virginia. She is the founder of Nuna Med, named derived from nurtured and nature. Nuna Med and is an herbal products company that is an herbal products company offering botanically based solutions for common ailments. With 2 master's degrees, 1 in business administration and 1 in public policy, Ms. Barda is also a real estate developer committed to creating sustainable and aesthetically minded projects. Visit her website at nunamed.com. Ms. Barda.
So hi everybody, good morning, thank you for being here. I am Ali Barda, and just to talk about my family, growing up, I was really fortunate. I am the oldest of 4 kids. My parents have been together for, like 35 years now. And I grew up in a really supportive and loving environment where they let us try different things, and the most important thing was always trying to be a nice person and treat other people how you want to be treated. And so it was a pretty charmed upbringing. We all managed to, I guess, grow up and grow and learn from each other as siblings. At the same time, we would fight and we'd get angry and we'd slam doors and all of that. And there are some regrets I have about hurting my brother, who's closer to me in age, because we got mad about something. But at the same time, that was pretty much my childhood. And so I think when you grow up in that environment, you're like, okay, it's always going to go on like this. But sure enough, things got a little harder as we got older. My sister Mackenzie, who's the baby of the 4 of us, she ended up developing anorexia back when she was in about middle school. And it was hard on us as a family because she's the baby girl. We love her to death. And so it was a dark chapter in our lives with that. And I'm happy to say that I think with anorexia, you're always recovering. But she's done an unbelievable job getting where she is today, and now she's in college and a junior at TCU, Texas Christian University. And she is an inspiration to me because she's taken that and she's written a cookbook called Dormez, which tells her story and it helps other students create healthy meals in their dorms with limited ingredients, and it's available on Amazon. Little Mackenzie Emerald, shout out should you all want it. Works for adults too. And I would say, other than that as well, things changed when a few years ago, I'm standing as I was in an awful accident, and that was really difficult on our family, particularly my dad, because sometimes he can be a little bit emotionally repressed, and it had us all dig deep and realize how important those family ties are. And I am really blessed that we pulled through together, even when we didn't really know what the outcome would be. And it was very trying, not only on me and my parents and my siblings and my now husband, but also our extended family, because it kind of shattered the safety net that we all felt. And then also, it's been a change, I'd say, in terms of it's crazy now, but in July, it'll be my 4-year wedding anniversary, and I pulled up some statistics because I wanted to see how things changed over time, with marriage in particular. I married the guy that I met on an airplane my senior year of college, but in 1947, the average Census Bureau age for men to get married was 23.7, and women was 20.5, whereas in 2016, 29.5 for men and 27.4 for women. I was almost 27 when we got married. But it's been interesting, too, in terms of you get married and you have a whole new family. And so it's been fantastic. I absolutely love my in-laws. There are times where they have a different experience than I did growing up, especially because they're Austrian. And so my husband's the first one in his family that was ever born in the United States. And he grew up speaking German, so German was his first language. And just in terms of, like, my family is typically very open and we share things, and theirs is more insular and you keep it within the family. And that's been particularly hard recently because my husband's brother, who's 7 years older, has been struggling with substance abuse. And so it's been tough on the whole family. And there was one quote that I read recently, and it was about addiction. It's never a one-person sport where you can stand on the sidelines. Eventually, the whole family gets involved, and that's exactly the way it is. And so it's tricky, too, because in that case, I don't really know his brother. They always lived far away, him and his then-wife, but they're now getting a divorce. They were in Seattle, then they moved to Austria, and so even with technology and everything that we have now at our disposal, where you can Skype and FaceTime and feel like you are connected, if you're not physically in the same place, sometimes it's hard to get the whole story, particularly with addiction. And so that's where family is now. I guess no family is perfect. I'm sure that on the outside growing up, we seemed like we had it pretty together, but we've been fortunate to get through things together without always having it together. But overall, I'm very grateful for my family and where it's gotten me today, because I wouldn't be where I am without them.
Did both your parents work?
Great question. I meant to talk about that. So my dad worked. This is, I guess, where we're fairly unconventional, is my dad worked, but mostly from home. And so he was very much part of our upbringing. And my mom was a stay-at-home mom. Having 4 kids is definitely a handful. And they were in a fortunate economic position where they could do that. So great question. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Allie.
Next, we have Tulio Cardozo. He is a website developer with expertise in cloud infrastructure and web security, among other things. He works with incarcerated web developers as a technical manager with The Last Mile Works, a joint venture with a California prison industry authority. The Last Mile Project is a nonprofit started in 2010 that teaches business and technology skills to incarcerated men and women. Mr. Cardozo works to end the digital divide. I would like to add that he is the second generation Tulio, and his 2.5-month-old, his father's name is Tulio, his name is Tulio, and he has a 2.5-month-old baby boy in California named Tulio. Look for more of his incredible story on TEDx and thelastmileradio.org, Mr. Cardozo.
Thank you for the gracious introduction. Can everybody hear me good? Okay, great. So I guess the best way to describe my family and our dynamics, you know, what the bio doesn't say is like all of the things that go home, and kind of how Ali was saying this is you don't really realize from the outside looking in what, how things really are. I'm in a very loving family, but we definitely have a different dynamic than most. I'm a father, I'm a stepfather, I'm a husband, and I'm a son. And for me, each of those things have been journeys with those people in our own unique and distinct way. I'm a stepfather to two beautiful young women. My oldest daughter, I call her my daughter because I love her as my daughter. Marina, she's getting ready to go to college. And, you know, she's had a really rough life. Her biological father was killed when she was 4 years old as a victim of mistaken identity. He was in a car with his best friend, and somebody drove by and shot him with an AK-47 many times. And the guy that they meant to kill drove him to the hospital, but unfortunately he drove him to a smaller hospital that couldn't save his life in time. And she's been processing a lot of that. And definitely her relationship with me has been very difficult because I'm not her father and I'm with her mom. And, you know, she really wants to have that American dream of being with mom and dad. And Tulio was not part of that picture. It's interesting because she really loves me a lot and appreciates that I can support her as a person. But I'm not her dad. And so she's always held on to that, like, I start getting close, and then it's like, oh, I gotta back up, you know, because she's betraying her father. I'll touch back on her in a second. Leticia, she's my youngest daughter, but she's really my stepdaughter. She's also from a different father. And, you know, my wife at the time was going through emotions with what happened with her, Marina's dad, and frankly, a one-night stand that she didn't want to have an abortion over. The guy that is Leticia's father is, in my own words, just an asshole. You know, he's got like 5 other kids. He doesn't care about any of them. Doesn't care about Leticia. I encouraged him and my wife to have him come into our life. And all he cared about was hitting on my wife. He really didn't care at all about Leticia. And so, you know, we haven't really seek that anymore. Leticia is a wonderful, wonderful, smart girl. She's only 11. My wife, obviously, I love her to death. And, you know, the thing with her is she's had a pretty rough upbringing with her kids. She had her kids at a young age. She's gone through some difficult challenges. She had to step away from her education to take care of them at first. And, you know, she's got a lot of different personal things that she's processing. And I love her very much because I can relate with having to process a lot of different things. And, you know, somebody else who in my life has taught me how to deal with and process things was actually my own mother. My mom is a really interesting woman. She really wasn't a fan of the country she grew up in, so she decided to explore the world when she was 18 and traveled all over. She supported herself by shipping cool things from other countries back home to Argentina, where a friend of hers sold them at a consignment store. Doing that, she was able to travel to just about everywhere that's cool, from Egypt to New York, Indonesia, Thailand, India, Tibet, like all kinds of places. She tells me really interesting stories and used to speak about 6 languages fluently at the peak of her life. But all that kind of came to an end for her when we moved to the United States and she was a victim of domestic violence. And, you know, she was taken for all her money, and we lived in a battered woman shelter for about 3 years. And she's had to really do a 180 on her life, going from the type of lifestyle and the type of person she was in stature to being a housekeeper, because the skill that she had didn't really translate here in the United States. And for me, that was really tough to deal with as a child at first. But the interesting thing was, is I realized what an amazingly strong woman to not care about anything other than to provide for me and to make sure that we always had. And I love her very much. She's still alive to this day. She's 79 years old. And she was the last person I saw before I came here. I gave her a nice big hug, told her I love her. And I gave her a beso grande, which means a big kiss. The interesting dynamics of my life is that I realize that, like with Marina, I missed somebody very important. My own biological son, TJ, that's his nickname, is actually Tulio Christopher Cardozo. TJ got his first name from my father because my father passed away when I was about two years old. I had just turned two, and I never knew my father. But I named him after my father in memory of him because I really wanted to live for my father what I think he was trying to live with me. The really interesting thing about TJ is TJ has brought my entire family together. It's really weird. I didn't expect that. From that regard, you know, Marina flipped out when Crystal and I decided to get married. I mean, she threw a huge tantrum. When we had a child, she said her life is over. You know, started using drugs, marijuana, and I was like, come on now, this is not an excuse to screw up your life. Like, I'm not saying marijuana is bad or good, but I'm just saying, like, don't use excuses to do those things. She's since stopped, thankfully. She wants to go to college, and she got into the places that she tried to apply to, and so she's definitely right on the right thing. But I'm bringing this up because when TJ was born, he changed our family. Marina blossomed overnight and actually had a heart-to-heart with me one day, because she realized, like, hey, this is the best thing that ever happened. Like, it really solidified our dynamics. Leticia has always loved me. She told me when she was 5 years old, she understood about her dad. She pulled me to the side one day when we were camping and said, I know you're not my dad, but I don't care. I love you. I want you to be my dad. I appreciate when you're mad at me. I appreciate when you're happy for me. I appreciate when you tell me that I'm doing good and when you tell me I need to do better. And, you know, for a five-year-old telling you that, like, on the edge of the lake, I mean, it's really, it hit. I tell my wife, like, I'll never leave you. Because when I went through a lot of hard times in my life, I had somebody leave me at a moment where it was really hard. I had to learn how to self-sustain. And I could never do that to somebody that's raised such beautiful people and that I'm sharing life raising beautiful people with. If I was to sum up what each of these people want from me, you know, I would say that Marina, well, let me start off with Leticia. I would say Leticia, would, like, what she wants of life is just to look at me and say, Daddy, love me. Marina would say, Tulio, be proud of me. Crystal would probably say, you sure you still want to be here with me? TJ would probably just say, like, tickle my left cheek and give me a bottle pretty soon. But to all of them, I would say that I love you, I'm proud, and I'll always be here with you. And, you know, that's my family. From the outside, you know, it feels nice, but on the inside, boy, was it a journey to get here. And, you know, we're all doing good together now. We're a nice, big, happy family. Thanks.
Thank you. Carolina Quiroga Stoltz, recipient of numerous awards and recognition, is the recipient of numerous awards and recognitions. Ms. Quiroga Stoltz has earned 2 master's degrees, 1 in storytelling and 1 in arts management. She is a self-taught performer and storyteller performer and demonstrates her craft throughout the world. Bilingual, Ms. Quiroga, storytelling and performances are dedicated to the myths, legends, and
folktales of Latin America and Hispanic cultures. Look for her engaging performances on YouTube and visit her website at carolinastoryteller.com or visit her podcast, bilingual podcast, Trey Cuentos. Ms. Quiroga.
Well, hello, everyone. My name is kind of hard to pronounce. Actually, my real name is Carolina Andrea Quiroga Hurtado. But I had to adjust it when I came to this country. So I'm from Colombia, South America. I've been here in the United States for about 7 years. It's a big journey. I always thought I was the only child until I met my older brother, half-brother, but I call him brother, when I was 11. And then I thought we were the two of us. Not that he lived with us, but I know he existed, right? And then I found out when I was 24 that I was the middle child because my dad had another child when I was 11. So I'm the only child that grew up with my dad. My dad was married to my mom for 25 years. But I do have a half-brother and half-sister from different moms. And we all, in our individual cosmos, we are, only child. That's the word. Yeah. And we all act like only children. So in Colombia, unfortunately, there's this thing that we all believe, a lot of people believe that in Colombia or in all Latin America, there's this thing called machismo, and so men are patriarchal. But when I came to this country, I realized that's just everywhere around the world. It's not only us, so don't blame us for that. But people like doing that because it makes them feel better. Oh, you guys, your men are all machistas, right? And I'm like, well, yours are too. Okay. So my journey with my family is my parents married because my mom was reaching 30, and at that time a woman that is in her 30s is going to become a nun or, you know, vestir santos, dress saints. Yeah, you're never going to get married if you're in your 30s. So they weren't friends, and my mom had some disappointments in life, I guess. And my dad traveled away, and this is how he would say it. He married my mom because she was an educated woman. That's the only reason. That's it. And so he wrote letters to her, and since she was not getting married, she said, okay, I'll marry you. That's it. It sounds like Middle Eastern type of thing. Got convenient. And so she moved away from her family, far away, and she had to start her own journey. And my dad was not the very most pleasant husband. He's a great father to me. Okay? But he was not the best husband. So it was pretty hard. My dad was very verbal abusive with her for so many years until I was 11 and I one day got in the middle of the fight. I guess my mom was, I remember I was in the studio and I was like working on the computer or playing games, I don't know. And they would always have these big fights and they would close the door so I wouldn't, you know, hear.
But of course you can hear because they're yelling. Duh.
For so many years, I was asking, please make the peace, love each other, you know, those things that children believe. And when I was 11, I was like, no, this is not working. So I started telling my mom, Mommy, you gotta get divorced, seriously. She's done not working. And I remember that time she was so scared and she ran into the office and you could tell that she was just frightened. Now, he never hit her. He was not that type of abusive. It was the verbal. And that's, to me, that was enough. I was 11, I stood up and I stood between both of them. I said, next time you just have to go through me, man. And since then I became like the person that was always defending her, which actually deteriorated my relationship with my father. And I had a really good one because I was the little girl. I mean, he truly adored me. But after that, I was always defending my mom. And it became a comfortable position for her too. because when you find someone that is your shield, you start, I'm sorry to say this, but if you're a victim for too long, that becomes comfortable at some point. And I always pointed out to my mom, if you're tired of this, how come you're not getting divorced? I mean, I'm getting tired of defending you too. This is pretty exhausting. But she always said, and it was something in her generation, a woman cannot live without a man. And if she goes outside into the world, everybody's going to point at her because she's divorced, and so she probably did something wrong. Not the man, okay. He has 3 kids from 3 different women, right? But he didn't have anything wrong. But she would suffer from that. That's what she always thought. So it took her so long to actually one day get the courage and say, okay, I'm done. Story is really funny, but I'm not gonna share it right here. It's kind of degrading too. The reason why she finally said, I'm done. But finally, she did it. And when I moved out, I'm 25 years old and I'm still living with my parents. And the main reason is because my dad wanted an engineer in the house. He couldn't get it with my brother because my brother was so far away and my brother did economics. So he thought, okay, well, that kind of satisfies me. When it came my turn to study something, I said, I would like to do anthropology, sociology, history, psychology, or the social science. He said, no, we're going to do engineering or medicine. That's it. So I chose the easiest way, which was industrial engineering. But through the whole 5 years of doing that, it was hell for me. I hated it. Every single moment, I hated it. We had so many fights. I even cheated on an exam to try to, you know, get caught and get expelled from there and have a good reason to say, see, I suck at this, Dad. No, the teacher, we failed in that class, of course, but that was it. He didn't expel me, and I was hoping to get, but no, I didn't. He didn't even go through my records. And my dad was like, everyone makes mistakes. I was like, oh, damn. So anyway, after that, I figured out I'm not going to get out of this that easily, right? So finally, when I was fifth semester, I said, you know what, this is what we're going to do. I'm going to finish this. But once I finish, you're going to help me study what I want. He said, sure. And I'm pretty sure in his mind, he was thinking, that's never going to happen. Because the moment she graduates, she's going to want to make money, right? And she was going to try to go with the flow. Everybody wants to get jobs and all that. And she's going to forget about it. Well, not me. So after 8th semester, I went into graphic. I said I wanted to do journalism communications. My dad said, no, hell no, you're not doing that. And the main reason is because it's Colombia, it's the 90s, and a lot of journalists are getting killed. So I studied graphic design. And I managed to finish the other one, and I did graphic design. Eventually, I switched to communication, so I have a big background right there. But it has taken me at least 15 years to steer the wheel of my own boat, of my own car, to where I want it. And I'm just getting there. And I'm happy about it. I'm happy the struggles, and I wish perhaps it would have been faster. Sometimes I wonder where would I be right now if I had saved myself those kind of 10 years of extra doing things that I never used. But it has made me who I am today, and I think that's pretty valuable. Now, I do have a good relationship with my brother and sister, not that I talk to them that much. They do hold against my dad the fact that he was never with them. And I always tell them, oh man, you didn't want to be there, believe me. No, you didn't. You just saved yourself from that big headache. You guys got to do whatever you wanted. You got guys to study what you wanted, do everything. I have to put up the fight. You had a phone of that over the phone. I got it right there all the time, right on my back, every single moment. I love my father, but he's a very complex man, and my mom is a complex woman too. I was sharing this story with someone else the other day, and she said, and what was your mom doing? I mean, you know, it's your mom. She's the one supposed to. And I was like, well, it's, as it happens sometimes with victims, she's stoned. She doesn't know how to get out. I don't blame her. So, but we got out of that. My dad married again, and my mom is happy not married. She's like, I will never do that again in my life. It took me many years. I just got married about 5 years ago, and I'm 38. I always said I'm never going to get married.
Never, never, never.
If I'm going to find a guy like my dad, no, no, no. Not even, I mean, after that, it can only work worse. So, no. It took me forever, and finally, I found an amazing man, and well, he's the love of my life. That's my story.
Thank you. Nancy Janis. Among other interests, Dr. Janis focuses on children and youth in the global context, including human trafficking. As a professor of human development at Eckerd College in St. Petersburg, Florida, where she has taught for more than two decades, Dr. Janis is an inspiration to all who know her. She was hit by a van 7 years ago while bicycling, yet continues to work and recreate in spite of her disability. She and her husband, who's here today, adopted three daughters from Colombia. Dr. Janis.
Well, thank you. Can you hear me? I can't get a lot closer to the microphone. Maybe I can hold it. Wait. How's that? Okay. You know, I am, by decades, the oldest person on this panel. And so, as my colleagues on my right have been talking about their families of origin, I wondered if I should talk about my family of origin or if I should talk about the family that I've created. So I decided I would give you the quick and dirty on the family of origin and then move on to the family that I've created. I was born to an older dad, a good bit older than my mother, who died when I was 3 years old. And I have actually only one visual memory of him when I was probably around 3 years old. And my mother remarried shortly thereafter. She married a man who happened to be a vice president of the Wrigley Company in Chicago. And so I grew up chomping a lot of chewing gum. And he had previous, my biological father had, let me make this simple. My mother was the fourth wife of each of her three husbands. What? Something that I would never in my life have repeated. I don't think. I didn't anyway. But so I had a slew of half-siblings, and the ones from my biological father were a lot older than me. His youngest son was 20 years older than I was, and I adored him because when I was little, he would throw me in the air and catch me, and I thought that was just wonderful. And then my stepfather, the one that my mother married after him, they only stayed married about 6 or 7 years. And he had three children from a previous marriage. The two boys were close in age to me. One was a couple years older, and one was 3 months younger. And they lived with us for a year, which I thought was great because I had been an only child, and suddenly I had playmates. However, their mother decided, according to my mother, decided that she should take them back because my mother had given me the younger boy's socks. Now, that's my mother's obvious distortion probably of what actually happened. But anyway, they left my life by the time I was about 11. And then my mother went through a period of dating a lot of men. And my mother was really, really beautiful. And so it was easy for her to find people who wanted to date her. And I have these memories. This was, for me, the hardest part of my life because I was just getting into puberty and was developing interests in boys. And so I was also nosy as could be, and I loved to sleep in my mother's bed with her. And and next to her bedroom there was a den, and so she would entertain her dates in the den. And I remember myself at about 12 years old with a glass on the wall trying to listen to what was going on in that den. And I'm not going to do it, but I actually could name for you every one of those men that she was dating. And the only thing that was really terrible about it was that at one point she started dating a man who was the grandfather of a boy in my class. And I decided that would be the ultimate humiliation if she married this grandfather. And then she dated one, I called him Mr. Kelly. I was always taught, you know, that as a young person, you call all the older people Mr. or Mrs. And I liked Mr. Kelly a lot. And I thought, oh, that'd be cool if she married Mr. Kelly. But she didn't, because she told me Mr. Kelly didn't have a chin. My mother would probably roll over if she could hear all of this. But anyway, she eventually did marry one whom I really, really didn't like. And in the end, they stayed married for some 40 years or more. My mother predeceased him. She was 9 years older. And she predeceased him by about 5 years, I think. And I have to say, in those last 5 years, when he was a widower, I grew to care for him. I would go out, he was in Arizona, and I would fly out there and I would visit him and go to the place he was living in a, I don't think we say nursing home. I think he was living in an assisted living at the end of his life. And so I would go out and visit him, and I did develop fond feelings for him. He was a much nicer older man than he was a younger man. So he got nicer to my mother and he got nicer to me, but we didn't have a whole lot in common, I would say. So that brings you up now to the fact that one other thing I need to say about my mother that's probably important to the story is that my mother was a person who really didn't feel that a woman could survive without a man. And so, you know, she went between my biological father to my first stepfather to the stream of men to the marriage to my final stepfather. And she used to communicate that to me, you know. Nancy, she would say, you turn all the boys into friends. Wouldn't you like to have a boyfriend? So finally, when I met a boyfriend, I actually was 14, so I started pretty young, and he was really tall, and that was about all it took for me to like him. So I developed a lot of dependency on that boy. And so in the end, he asked me to marry him when we were in college. And I didn't particularly want to, but I figured I'd waited all those years and dreamed about, fantasized it, so I'd better do it. So I was married previously, and we were married 7 years. We did the Peace Corps together, which is, I really am happy about having done the Peace Corps, with or without him. I'm just really happy that I did it. And then after 7 years, we divorced. And at that point, that was in the mid-70s. And that's exactly the time period that people said that couples who were going to divorced after 7 years. So to my horror, I did what everybody did according to what was said. And then I was single for quite a long while. And eventually, I moved around a lot. I did grad school. I became a college professor. I lived with a man for a while that was much too old for me. And then eventually, I moved to Connecticut. And I was going to be teaching at Southern Connecticut State University. And I met this very attractive man in a little shop. And I promise I'll get to the family in a minute. But I spoke to him. He was there with a child, and I was there with a girl who was a former kind of mentee of mine. And I spoke to him, and I did this very brazen thing. I picked up a little figurine off a table, and I turned to him. I didn't know him, of course, and I said, "You should buy this." And so he and I got talking, and anyway, from there it goes on. He wrote me a couple of letters. He found out who I was and wrote me a couple of letters, and we started dating, and we got married. And that was, for me, surely the best thing that I had ever done to that point. And we're still married 31 years later. Now, he had 3 sons from his first marriage, and I had no children from my first marriage. And I never thought I wanted to be a mother. I was always a career woman, you know, and I was always interested in what I was doing. And he and I went to buy a marriage license. And at that time, there was somebody in the town clerk's office that had a little, maybe a year old, maybe a year and a half old, Korean adoptee sitting on the counter. And that little kid was so cute. And we went ahead, you know, we got our marriage license, and we walked out of the town hall, and I burst into tears. And that was really the first inclination, or recognition, I should say, that I really would like to be a mother, and I really would like to make a family. And my husband, well, he wasn't yet, because we just got our wedding license, but my then boyfriend is the most psychic person I've ever met. And he said he knew from the very beginning that I wanted to have children. So we went on from there, and we married, and we decided, I at that point was 40, and he was 42, and we decided that we would adopt children internationally. We decided to adopt internationally, partly because we both had really strong international inclinations, and partly because that was the time, you may remember, when Mary Beth Whitehead had been the surrogate mother for a couple that did surrogacy, and she wouldn't relinquish the baby at the end. And it felt to us as though the whole area of building families in alternative ways was not so very clear in the United States, and we felt somehow more secure doing it internationally. However, we learned quickly that because we were, I think I was younger than 40 at that point, maybe 39 and a half, so because that was our age, we were not eligible to adopt in Asia. China was not open, Eastern Europe was not open, and people told us the only place that you will be acceptable as adoptive parents, given your age, is Latin America. And so as we explored the adoption possibilities in Latin America, we recognized that the single most important thing to both of us was that any child that we would adopt internationally had not in any way been coerced from her, his birth mother. We learned that Colombia at that time had the longest history with international adoption, and it had the laws that were the most protective of birth mothers. They had 28 days after they signed papers to change their minds. And so we felt that that was the best shot we had at adopting children whose birth parents had been given a chance. So we adopted our first daughter. Oh, when they called us to tell us they had a child for us, I immediately assumed, you know, given our age, now by now I was 40 and he was 42, that they were going to call and say, "We have a lovely pair of 12-year-old Siamese twins to offer you." But they didn't. They offered us an infant girl who was a treasure. And so we brought her home and fell totally in love with her, and are still. And then decided I was an only child, and I didn't want to raise an only child because I always wanted siblings, still do. And so 2 years later, we adopted our second daughter from the same program in Colombia. And she was a healthy little thing when we got her. She was like kind of a little tubby, strong baby. And she was only 9 weeks old. And then I started working on Brian not too much longer, I guess. We'd had her for a year and a half. And I started working on him for a third. Now, mind you, he had three sons. So I was kind of working on him for a sixth. But anyway, I kept giving the rationale that I was a professor and my children were going to get free college education. We didn't have to worry about that. And we still had lots of love going and so on. And so eventually I twisted his arm. And that was a wonderful thing to have done because we adopted our third daughter, her name is Carolina, and she is now 25. My kids, these girls, have got grandparent parents. And I one time promised them that if ever they were embarrassed to have such old parents, I would dye my hair. One of them once suggested maybe that would be a good idea. And I tried it and came out of it looking as though I had this brown beanie on my head. And the girls were more embarrassed of the way I looked like that than they were of having this graying haired mother. So at this point, now they're grown, and they are really, they've just turned into wonderful, wonderful people. Our oldest daughter is 31, so we always remember that we've been married 31 years. And Brian and I went to teach on semester at sea in the fall of 2017, and while we were on the ship somewhere in Asian waters, my daughter informed us that she was pregnant. So that was kind of a shock and something for us to deal with because we'd never met the guy. Well, anyways, now she's had a baby, and the baby is absolutely the light of our lives. This little, he's just he's 9 months old now, and he's adorable, and they live with us, and so we're living very happily with our oldest daughter and her son, and then my second daughter is 28, and when she was 14, we found out something she already knew, I guess, which was that she was gay. And at that point, because we're older families, we grew up, you know, in the years that it was not good to be gay and people discriminated and treated you meanly and all. And so we found that pretty disturbing because we imagined this child that we adored was going to have an unnecessarily difficult life. But she hasn't. And she is now living with a partner whom we like very much. And everything is good. The only thing is they live an hour and a half away. And then my youngest daughter, who's 25, her story is a little sad right now, but it's delightfully happy at the same time. She joined the Peace Corps after she graduated from college, and she has some learning disabilities and has always done okay in school despite, but when she joined the Peace Corps, she went to Guatemala, and she went through Peace Corps training up until the last 3 weeks, and then they told her that her Spanish had just not come along quickly enough, and they didn't feel that without better Spanish that she could do the job. So now she came home, heartbroken, of course, and lived home with us for a couple of months. And now she's living in Colombia, in Medellin, which is where she was born, living at a Spanish immersion hostel where she gets 20 hours of Spanish instruction a week and a few private lessons and making friends. And she's just very happy down there. And I'm going to share this, and it'll be the very last thing I say, for Carolina's benefit. And that is that Kari yesterday sent me a WhatsApp in which she said, I'm really happy. And I wrote her back and I said, tell me about what makes you really happy. And she wrote back right away and she said, it's the people. They're so warm. They hug you. They kiss you on the cheek when they greet you. And they're always together. And I thought that was just such wonderful music, because I think that's, if anything is really missing from our lives in America, I think it's that kind of expressive closeness that she's experiencing down there. So that's enough from me.
Thank you. Very good. In the interest of time, I would like to read three questions, and you may speak to whatever question you'd like. We have about 20 minutes before we have to end already. In the future, if the future is without family, what would it require? Another question is, how have you seen the influence of your parents affect your personal relationships? And another question is, what policy efforts, are there policy efforts, and what are they, might support children better in dysfunctional families? If you'd like me to repeat a question, let me know. And speak in the order that you choose.
So I'd love to just jump into the second question. Like, how has your parents influenced, what was the exact wording?
How have you seen the influence of your parents affect your personal relationships?
Okay, perfect. Yeah. That one, when I heard it jumped out at me. So, like I said, my mom basically, like, had to make it work. Like, I remember when she first came to this country, my English was much better than hers because I was a kid and I picked it up. And sometimes she would even, like, you know, write the check. She'd be like, hey, write the number down for me. And I'd be like, no. She's like, you have to. And so the point being is like, one of the things I heard throughout my entire life is just, you don't try, you do it. Like, you have to. Like, in everything that I grew up, is you have to. To the point where, like, when I went through a fire and, you know, third-degree burns of my body, and, like, I got left, and I didn't have anybody to take care of me, and I technically needed somebody to take care of me, like, I remember, like, in my heart, I'm like, I have to. I've always been super rigid on myself because she was so rigid on me. I can't even walk slow. Like, I gotta hurry because she always had to hurry. My kids hated me. It's had an effect on my relationship because my wife's family, you know, they're very different. And I work with people in the prison system that also come from very different backgrounds. And to me, it's very natural to be like, you gotta just do it. And it's hard for me to frankly take it back a notch and to realize that, like, no, you don't have to. And it's totally acceptable for somebody to do it their way. But as simple as that sounds, like, boy, did that cause so much marital problems at first before we got married. And, I mean, it's been tough. And even after we got married, it's been tough. And in my mentorship relationships with people that I help, it's sometimes been tough because what's painfully obvious to me is you don't have to. It's like, actually, no, Tulio, you're wrong. You're kind of being an asshole here. You have to let people take it. You got to come to them and you got to let them, you know, do it on their pace. So I would just say that, like, you know, I didn't have my father when I grew up. I just had my mom, single child, single parent. She worked as much as possible, and that was the one thing. And to this day, I'm still struggling with that because, like, I've had a major life transition and stuff, and I'm really dealing with it hard. And I'm still like, you have to, and it's like, oh shit, no, I don't have to. I got to figure it out. So, yeah, I guess I have to answer that question.
For me, I'm sure you got it from when I spoke, but my parents and their influence on me is tremendous. I would definitely not be who I am without them. And it was unconventional in terms of modern days, I suppose, where my dad was mostly home working. And my mom had a really hard full-time job of raising us four kids. But the values that they instilled in us, my mom was really big on quotes. And so in our minivan growing up, she had a sticker that was "Think good thoughts," which I don't know if you can really force yourself to think good thoughts when you aren't. But there was that. And then like on the refrigerator, we had "Be respectful, be resourceful." And now I'm forgetting the last one. Responsible. Be responsible. And so I think those things really shaped who I am and who my siblings are. But I also have a really soft spot for foster children. And so I've spent a considerable amount of time both as a CASA, court-appointed special advocate, guardian ad litem, when I was living in North Carolina, advocating on behalf of foster children. And I was on one case for about 4 years. And then when I was in graduate school doing my master's in public policy, my final kind of thesis project was focused on retaining volunteers to help CASA, because a lot of these kids who bounce around from foster care, they don't have that continuity. And if you can have volunteers stick with the kids and keep your volunteers, it's fantastic for everything. And so for me, I would say to that first question of what would the world look like without family, I think it would be sad. It would be really difficult and really hard, because that's been the foundation for me and so many other people. And I've seen when you lose that foundation and you don't have that security, especially as a child, it can be really difficult. And fortunately, there are families out there. In the case that I was on, like, her grandmother took her in, and that gave her a certain element of continuity and understanding where she came from and all of that, that helped the girl and now woman that I advocated on behalf of. And so I'm a big fan of, it doesn't have to look like two married parents and a bunch of different kids that come from those same parents, but at the same time there needs to be a lot of love and hopefully some values that are instilled on them that then can be replicated and re-ingrained in the classroom. And from there on out, I think we all need to band together and be with each other and support each other and support our families and friends, and then hopefully that makes society all the better.
Okay. I think I'm going to pick up on the last question, the policy question for dysfunctional families. I think at the base of so many problems in the world and here, the key is tied in with education. And I think that many families really have no vision of what a healthy family looks like. And I would like very much, in terms of policy, and I'm not much of a policy person, honestly, but in terms of policy, I would like to see the public schools become much more involved with families in addition to children. And I think very often, I'd spent a few years as a school psychologist and a few years as a French teacher, and I think that the schools tend to write off families and say, our job is the children. Back in the last school where I was a school psychologist, the school was more forward-looking, I think, and they used to allow me to do family counseling in the evenings if I wanted to, and then take the equivalent amount of time off during the day. I don't know that that's such a practical idea in a big way, because the school staff would be out nights and not during the day at all. But I think that providing more support, more education for families, and more vision of what a healthy family is like would go a long way toward helping children that are coming from these most dysfunctional families.
Thank you. Just to answer the first and the last one, for the first one, I would say if you like science fiction, you have to read The Foundation from Isaac Asimov, and there you'll find the answer to that first question. It's pretty much in the last book.
Now, as for the last question, I already forgot it. What was it?
Have you seen the influence? The first question she referenced with the book was, what's the future look like without families?
Mm-hmm.
And the next question is, how have you seen the influence of your parents affect personal relationships?
I would go with the last one about the politics and education. I work in schools all the time going to tell stories to children and all that good stuff. And I always tell the parents that we need to re-educate parents. And this one, I'm not sure if it's going to land very good with anybody, with you all, but I think that the definition of family should not be based on the Bible, as a man and woman be together forever, no matter what. Because from there comes all the shame and all the struggles and the fact that some people, sometimes it just doesn't work out. That's it, right? That's it.
Okay. Our next question is, talk about women with career objectives beginning a family in their later years. What are the problems associated with this?
I'm 38. I don't have children. This has been a big struggle for me. I always thought if I ever had children, I would like to adopt. My husband, of course, he's actually 5 years younger than me, and he would like to have his own children. But for about 5 years, I've been lying to myself, and I think lying to the world, telling everybody that, yes, we're trying to have children, but the truth is that for 5 years, I've told myself, no, I don't want to. I'm not ready yet. And the whole point for me that not being ready yet is because it has taken me so long to accomplish my dream. Like, now I have children, I can't work. I will have to become a housewife. And sorry, I don't have anything against housewives, but that's not my dream. I work so hard. I have 2 bachelor's degrees, 2 master's degrees. I have to play tennis for 15 years because my dad wanted it. Jeez. This first time I own my life. But it doesn't mean that children are going to take my life away. It's just that I'm finally getting there. And if I add to the equation children, it's going to slow me down. And I know no matter how hard you try, not it is going to happen, because I don't have family in the United States. So who's going to take care of my children? And if I'm going to be a mom, I want to be the best mom ever. I don't want to leave them with anybody. My mom would have a maid to come and take care of me. Then she would find that they were bruising me every time I'm crying. So, I mean, there's a lot of abuse going on. And not because you have a babysitter that you trust is going to really work out. So I've been putting it off and off and off. And that's the truth. That I just finally got my life what I wanted, and now. So, but now I'm finally, I made my peace, and I said, okay, I think I can do it. And so this year we're for real trying. We'll see how it goes.
I think in some ways that question was dedicated to me, so I'll have to answer it. As I said, I never imagined that I was going to want children. And then I would tell you now that having adopted the girls was really, besides meeting the man with whom I adopted the girls, the very best and most important thing that I ever did. And so how did it work? When we first got Elena, the oldest, I had 6 weeks off as a sort of maternity leave, and then we had a girl from Germany who came and lived with us. She lived with us for a year, and she took wonderful care of Elena, and she was a delight. She's now a 50-year-old woman, would you believe? And we have remained friends, and in fact, my youngest, Kari, went to see her when she was in Germany a couple of years ago. And so I was allowed to continue working. And then when we adopted Susanna, our second daughter, once again we had help, and I was able to continue working. And with Kari, the same thing. I was able to continue working by getting the help that we needed. We never had the children cared for outside of the outside of our home. We didn't put them in professional daycare. I don't think. We may have put the oldest one in for a short time because she was actually, and still is, a pretty shy person. And we felt that she needed the socialization of being with other children. So I think we put her in daycare when she was four. And then went on to kindergarten in the same center. But we made it all work, and Brian was a great help, of course, and he was also an experienced father, so that was good for me. I was so inexperienced that the night before we got Elena, when we were going to fly to Colombia, I had him handing me pillows every 15 minutes just to see if I could hold the pillow properly and to get a little practice about this baby stuff. But anyway, I don't think children have to stand in the way of one's career. I think that there are times that they stand in the way when the child is sick and, you know, you can't find somebody who wants to stay with her when she's sick. But overall, I wouldn't give up one second that I've had with my daughters for anything. And still, you know, I'm a full professor. I had tenure until I got into the accident. So I've made it career-wise. I love being a professor, and I love being a mother. And other than the fact that my daughters are having to live with these ancient parents with gray hair, I think it's all worked out great.
We will have to wrap up at 10:10. They need to use the facility for the next group. I have a couple questions. I'll say two questions back to back, so you may address either one or both. Speak about single parent families when the woman is raising children. What would you do in that situation? And then the other one is, how can you successfully teach parenting in schools if there is so much difficulty teaching sex education?
Well, I think... Sorry.
Go for it.
I think parent education, as well as life skills, is a really valuable thing to be teaching in schools and should become part of everybody's curriculum. That, along with sex education. But to me, I'd like to see that developed as part of perhaps social studies curriculum or something, where it's treated all the time in schools and people get the fundamental knowledge of what we need from each other and how to provide that.
Here's my public policy education coming out again, but one of the best takeaways I had during getting an MPP was you don't necessarily have to recreate the wheel, and as an entrepreneur, it's kind of funny that I'm saying that, but as far as family education, I would love to see it more in schools, and I think instead of trying to make up a program from scratch, a lot of times you can adopt best practices from other places, and so I think it might be taking a global perspective and seeing where people are incorporating family education into schools, and then what the results are from that, and adopting best practices, and then trying to incorporate it in our curriculum and going from there. And I really like your ideas too, Nancy, about engaging, because maybe it's in a shop class or something like that, but if the parents are able to with their work schedules, and I realize that's very difficult, but if you could have a parent come in and build something together with the kid / student, I think that's a great opportunity for dialogue and conversation and learning together and continuing building the strong families.
All I have to say about that is my dad, once when we had a big fight, he said, "Well, you weren't born with a manual. How am I supposed to know how to exactly raise you?" And it is true. None of us come, when you come out of your mom's womb, you don't come with a manual. This is the best practice for these children, how to raise it. So I really think it's so important. We give for granted the whole parenting. You think it comes naturally because you watch others doing it, or because we're supposed to reproduce and have children, or because the Bible might give you a couple hints, but no, it's an individual journey. because each of us are one different story, one completely different universe.
Then if I just add one thing too, I think two things. The only manual I have ever seen from a parenting perspective is the little pictures of how to put a diaper on a baby in the back of a Huggies box.
You know? I don't know those ones yet.
Yeah, that's not a lot of info for the rest of their life. So yeah. But okay, so the thing I think single parent family in my household when I grew up, I can tell you one thing I didn't get was a whole lot of like sports, a whole lot of school activities, a whole lot of socialization with other kids or other parents outside of the ones that I put in my own life. I think watching other relatives raise their kids and raising mine, like, seriously, this might sound simple, but I think sports is a really big deal. Getting involved in after-school activities is a really big deal. Those kinds of things where like you socialize, just like how Nancy, you were mentioning about taking your daughter to a preschool so that, you know, she could be around other daughters and or other children rather and learn that. But I really can't understate how, looking back at my own life, like my mom couldn't do any of those things because she was working all the time. All she could do to show me love was give me $20 every now and then and say, like, you know, go get something nice to eat and I'll see you tonight. And, you know, I can't bust her chops about it. I don't. But I'm just saying that I think that that would really make a big difference as a parent. It does. I think. Anyways.
I'm glad we will end with that, Mr. Cardoza. I was hoping to hear from you one more time. It's 10:10 and we have to end. Let's give our participants a any of our speakers an additional question, they will make themselves available briefly before we need to clear out.
I just wanted to
thank you. If I can ever help out in any way.
I'll definitely will reach out.
And you know, do you like that? Do you want this to be right?
someone who can take